We're doing very well against the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're doing extremely well. They would like to do something, but I say they're not ready yet. They need more of the same. They're not ready yet. They got some evil intentions. We cannot let them have a nuclear weapon.
That was President Trump last night after the initiation of the 13th consecutive day of a return to war from Central Command. Explain to everybody that things are going fine. We just have to put a little bit more hurt on the Iranian side and then they'll come around. But they're evil, so that's going to be a problem too. We'll talk about those contradictions. And in fact, we're really, really happy to have Glenn Deason back with us today, professor of political science, and also the amazing Glenn Deason YouTube channel, where there's always great, great engagement there. And one of the reasons we sought you in the first place. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Well, thanks, Danny. It's good to be back.
And it's good to have you here. And we appreciate, by the way, that you're actually off on vacation today and you still made time for us. So we're very, very grateful for that. And pass our thanks on to your family as well for sharing you with us. Listen, let's just start off with the crazy statement there. Coming now at the whatever we're in, 140, 150 days of war, I can't remember what it is. We had this period of 40 days and 40 nights. That didn't accomplish the taking the Strait of Hormuz away from Iran. We tried the blockade. That didn't work. Then we went to the MOU. We did that for about 5 or 6 days. And then we started monkeying around with that. And then now we've gone back to basically just this continuous war over and over. First of all, let me just ask, just on the surface of it, of this new phase of it, this, I don't even know what we call it yet, this 13 straight days, what is do you see militarily? Because you see on the screen here, we get this 13 days in a row where they're just showing stuff on the ground that's getting hit in Iran. We don't even know what some of it is. Some of it's boats, but like, I don't know what that building is. It just looks like an explosion to me. What do you, how do you assess these 13 days and what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, that's the real question. And I think we're watching the death of strategic thinking because what is it that's actually going to be achieved? Initially, they began to talk about regime change, then they're going to liberate the Iranian women and the opposition. Then they're going to get rid of the nuclear program. They're going to scale back the ballistic missiles capabilities of Iran. I mean, one after the other, they keep changing the objectives. And now, when you listen to Trump, Hegseth, you often get the idea that they're measuring success simply in terms of the death and destruction they're able to bring to Iran. That is, first, they went after all these military targets. It's all celebrated as a measurement of success. Then they go after civilian targets. Look how much pain we can bring them. But again, this isn't an end in its, on its own. What exactly is the goal here? Because I don't think bringing death and destruction mean that much. The assumption by Trump appears to be if you bring enough pain to the Iranians, then they will fold. But for the Iranians, this isn't a possibility. Again, I always make the point when you want to assess a threat or you know an opponent, you want to look at the intentions and the capabilities. For the Iranians, this is an existential threat. They're fighting a war for their survival. They know that a defeat here would be, they would end up like a Libya or Syria or any other country, because neither the US or Israel could afford to see a powerful Iran in the region. So this is an existential threat. That means they will be able to absorb any pain that the US brings. And the other will be capabilities. It doesn't matter if one defeats, destroys a lot of their air force or their navy. The weapons they need to shut down the Strait of Hormuz and essentially deter the US, it often relies on drones, ballistic missiles, which they have a lot of. They're stored underground and they have the industrial capacity to ramp up production. So I think, as you said, what is the point here? What are they going for? And this should have been answered by Trump. When you go back to war after just taking the US out through the Memorandum of Understanding, why go back? What exactly are you going to achieve? Simply arguing, look at all the stuff we're blowing up. Again, we don't need context what they're blowing up to begin with. What's the point? I think it's PR, and Trump is great at branding and PR, but that's all it is. I mean, what exactly are they blowing up? That would be my first question.
And you know, you say he's an expert at PR, and that's what he's always been. That's how he got elected the first time. That's how he got elected the second time here, because he's just has shown he's just a master at manipulating things, whether that's the stock market, whether that's the paper price of oil, even against all the fundamentals, et cetera. He's been really great at that. However, it does appear that there's an expiration date on that, and it is finally starting to wear thin. Here, I'm going to show you a couple of things here that I think are really interesting here in just the last 24 hours or so. I'm going to show you a couple of things from Fox News, which, of course, has been the war central for President Trump, and that they have been pushing war like crazy, especially in the Middle East, but also to a lesser extent, but also in the Russia-Ukraine war. But now on this particular issue, there's starting to be some trouble. And we'll start first with Laura Ingraham, who had this. I think it was night before last.
With the midterm elections a little more than 100 days away, the clock is ticking for President Trump to get out of this war before voters head to the polls. It's making a lot of Republicans nervous. It's already, as we know, unpopular. According to the New Washington Post Ipsos poll, 69% of Americans disapprove of the handling of this conflict. Republicans cannot let this become an endless distraction, especially if they want to win in November.
Yeah, and an endless distraction and an endless war, because it seems like it's going on, and more on that in a second as well. But, I mean, listen, look, Laura Ingraham, and she put in, Gary, if you can find that, I forgot to signal you. If you can find, she put out an X post where she was also pretty straightforward saying, this is not working. This war is not working, and it's going to bring you down. If you can bring that up here, if you can find it. But Glenn, she's looking at the polling data. She hears from people. I mean, that's her job, to get a sense of the pulse of the audience so she knows where they're going and where to take them. And that's pretty strong, nearly 70%, which is, by the way, in historical terms, we've never had this much of a turn against a war this early. And I'm talking all the way back even before Vietnam, et cetera. So this is a long time, and it's a big deal. What do you make of it?
No, it's a massive defeat. And I think it's important to point out that no matter how successful you're at the PR war, at the end of the day, what happens on the ground will catch up with you. I think this is the case both with Iran and Russia. With Russia, of course, we're spinning this huge story now that, you know, the tide has turned. Suddenly we're winning, or we call it Ukraine is winning. Of course, you can do this for a while to drum up some public support for the war, to drag it on a little bit longer. But at some point, reality will catch up. And it's the same in Iran. Trump can, you know, sign the MOU, which he did, which was more or less a declaration of defeat, and just tell people that, no, it was a victory. You know, we didn't give them anything, even though people can read it. You know, you can do this for only so long. When defeat becomes obvious, at some point, reality catches up with you. And I think this has been also a key pain for the U.S., I think, as always, has now been the lack of escalation control. Because for the past 30 years, when the U.S. and NATO, for that matter, fought against very small, weaker countries, they had escalation control. They could decide when the war begins, when it ends, who should be involved, what are the legitimate targets. But there is no escalation control anymore. And this is the problem. If the war didn't go as planned, the U.S. didn't get its regime change, it couldn't do what it did last year with Yemen, that is simply say, oh, okay, we won, and then pull out and go back to the old status quo. It's very hard to sell a victory when you can't even go back to the old status quo. That is, the Iranians will hold on to the Strait of Hormuz. They will they can put pressure on the neighboring countries to shut down U.S. bases. They can do as they want, and there's nothing the U.S. can really do about it. This is, you know, this is a huge problem. I think if the U.S. could go back to the old status quo, open the Strait of Hormuz, there would be some way of, you know, spinning this as a victory by simply pointing out to how much death and destruction that has been dealt to Iran. But as long as the Strait of Hormuz is closed, it's Iran in control, there's no way for Trump to sell this as a victory. And this is going to have some, you know, huge consequences, as Ingraham said, in 100 days.
And, you know, and I think that he had a chance to do that. Gary, if you could bring that that Expos back up there. He had a chance with the MOU. He could have claimed victory there. He could have said it's going to take them decades to repair, and our blockade is left. We're going on, and let paragraph 5 play out. So Iran wants to take control of it. That's fine. They can have an administrative fee. That's fair. Whatever. But the bottom line is I can go back in and, you know, bomb them anytime I want to. He could have claimed it. The strait would have been open. And instead, now then, this is why this is so important, what she wrote here. The American people are done with war. They are not going to support war, she writes. They will not voluntarily pay for war. They will not make sacrifices for a war. I mean, this just goes on and on. This is one of the more powerful, concise things that I've seen in a long time from somebody, an anchor at Fox News. So what do you make of that? This is, to me, the biggest, other than the start of the war, the biggest unforced error was jamming up paragraph 5 of the MOU within 7 days is when we started that southern corridor on the Omani waters. How do you see it?
Well, there could be something big about this. I mean, during the Vietnam War, they made the point when they lost Walter Cronkite, when he didn't believe in the war anymore, then that was a good indication that things, that they were going to lose the media. This could be the same once you lose your biggest sycophants in Fox News. Your narrative control is going to begin to collapse. So, no, I think this is a huge problem for Trump. And I agree with what you said. He had an out with the memorandum of understanding. Sorry, he might fall into this trap again. That is, he can't go back to the old status quo. And if he wants to put an end to this war right before the elections and find some way of making this sound like a victory, I don't think it's going to be a possibility. The Iranians know that this could sink, tie Trump's hands if this election goes poorly. Why would they give him anything that looks like a win ahead of the midterm? So, no, this gives further leverage to the Iranians. So I just think this is a massive mistake. And again, if there was some great plan here in terms of what would be done differently, why go into a third round of a war with Iran? Well, what is the point? What are they going to do different? Are they going to do a ground invasion? Are they just going to go hard after the Iranian energy infrastructure? I mean, the Iranians, if there was a ground invasion, they would probably use this as a trap to begin to inflict massive casualties on the U.S. military. If they go after the energy infrastructure in Iran or civilian infrastructure in a bigger way, then imagine what would happen to Kuwait, to Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Jordan. I mean, there's an abundance of targets. And this is a key problem also for the U.S. That is, all the bases being placed in that part of the world to contain and surround Iran, they suddenly turned out to be a vulnerability because of the military capabilities of Iran. So I don't think Trump is calculating all the risks he's facing because the unknowns, that would be my main concern. It's going to be, there's too many actors here, too many variables. He can't control any of this. And too many things can and probably will go wrong. So again, why get back into this? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it doesn't make any actual sense, but there are those besides President Trump who are still not clear about reality. More on that in just a second. But let me continue down the initial path here. So I showed you Laura Ingraham, who's literally an anchor on the primetime shows on Fox in the evening. Maria Bartiromo is also really an important figure because she often interviews President Trump and, you know, puts out his messages, et cetera. And here's how she talked about it also, I think, yesterday.
I don't understand how it's possible that Iran has the capabilities to fight this way and continue to try to lash out at Gulf countries and U.S. military bases, because the U.S. has obliterated Iran's military and the president continues to reiterate that.
So she's like, I don't understand, because I keep listening to what President Trump says. And apparently, it looks to me like from her body language, I believe him when he says that we've destroyed all their Navy, their air defense, they're basically powerless. And then yet these drones and these missiles keep hitting our stuff day after day, killing our troops, wounding our troops, et cetera. But you see that she's starting to go, hang on a minute, something's not right here. When you're talking about these two mainstream figures here on the number one network that supports President Trump, what does this tell you about where the trends are heading?
Well, he's beginning to lose the media. And again, that's what my point was. You can only play this game for so long because, again, he said he obliterated their nuclear potential and then he has to go in and obliterate it one more time. It doesn't make any sense. He was making the point that they barely have any missiles left, yet their missiles keeps raining upon U.S. bases in the region. They don't have any more drones. Well, they apparently do. Makes the point that their navy is destroyed, their leaders are all killed, the Iranians are begging him for talks, yet you hear the exact opposite. You see the Iranians actually striking missiles, the missile strikes are getting, their missiles are getting faster and with better precision, and it's more and more difficult to intercept them. So Iran's capabilities appears to be growing, while the president of the United States says that they're pretty much on their knees begging for a good deal from the United States. But, you saw this during the MOU as well. That is, Trump signs under a deal which essentially puts $300 billion for reparation to fix in Iran what was broken. And at the same time, he's saying, well, we didn't give a cent. You can only make stuff up for so long. And again, I understand why the information war is important. You want to get public support behind the war. However, you can only string along the media for so long. I mean, we do the same with the Russians. We've been saying that since March of 2022 that the Russians were running out of missiles. It's been 4.5 years. Putin seems to get a new disease every week that he's going to die from. It's the Ukraine is winning. How long are they going to spin this? But again, we have a very obedient media in Europe, so they keep repeating whatever talking points NATO puts out there. But of course, people will start to doubt this after a while. It's like, yes, the Russians are retreating, but they're retreating forward. I mean, you can't make this up. But he will lose the media, and that's a great shame for him because. He's great at managing the media. This is essentially what keeps his head above water. Yeah.
So, he has been great at it, but now that shimmer is starting to come off. But it's not all a move in that direction. There are still some diehards that are going to say, no, we're going to keep pushing in the opposite direction, and we're not going to be deterred by the American public, the polling coming that direction, or by some of these figures starting to question things. But let's look, first of all, at some of his Senate supporters. This is Senator Daines talking about how actually things are going well.
You worried that maybe we're in a forever war again?
Nobody wants to end this conflict more than President Trump. He's executing a war at the moment to protect our children and grandchildren, to ensure this dangerous regime never has nuclear weapons and the ability to take the world to its knees. President Trump is working hard, but there's only one position that the Iranians respect, and that's the position of strength. They will get to a continued weakened posture, and I hope that will yield an outcome. A negotiated settlement would be the best outcome. But President Trump knows it is about peace through strength. He'll have relentless force used against this corrupt, evil regime until they are taken to their knees.
Until they're taken to their knees. You know, it used to be that politicians were great at, looking at the wind vane. Wherever the wind's blowing, that's where they'll go. But, I mean, even this one, you saw the Fox anchor set it up by going, hey, are we getting into a forever war? Which means he can see that everything we've tried is not working. He can see the polling that 69% of Americans think that this is a bad deal. And yet here he is talking about like, it's just a video game. I mean, I don't know. That's about the closest I can come up with it. No. All the things you're seeing, none of it's real. But here's what's real. We're going to bring them to their knees by trying the same thing that hasn't worked since February. I mean, what do you think about that?
No, it's just tough talk. There's no, again, I would like to hear the strategy. What exactly are they going to do differently? And I think a key problem is that there's no, I don't hear anywhere any actual assessment of what's going on because the way, same like the clip you just played, the lack of the shock that how is Iran possibly able to fight? Because we're always compelled to point out that our opponents are always motivated by evil intentions. They're all paper tigers. They're weak. If we just the pure evil, they're a huge danger to all of civilization. But they're also weak. So if we're just willing to confront this evilness, then they will fall apart quite easily. I mean, it's always the same script, but it's not working. So what can you do? But there was another aspect here. This whole focus, peace through strength. This is also what we say in our war against Russia. But I think this is a key flaw now of why this is very different from the other forever wars. That is, we used to fight weaker, medium to small countries, but now these large powers being fought, the Iranians, the Russians, economically the Chinese, it's very different. And, peace through strength is essentially a security in a hegemonic world. That is, usually if you have many powers balancing each other, peace means you have to chart out what are our key national security interests, what are the key security concerns and interests of our opponents. We figure out where these interests can be harmonized, what compromises are possible, how do we manage conflict where it's not possible to align our interests. But this is essentially managing the security competition. But we don't do this because ever since the end of the Cold War, we embraced a hegemonic concept of security. In this concept, you don't actually address the security concerns of your opponents. You say that peace will depend on you enjoying hegemonic strength, that is, being so powerful, it doesn't matter what the other great powers say because there's nothing they can do. This is the hegemonic peace, and that's why we always talk about peace through strength. We're going to be so dominant that this will lay the foundation for peace, but it's not an option anymore. And I think this is a key weakness because we don't do diplomacy anymore. I mean, I'm speaking as a European. We don't even want to talk to Russia, but we still say we would demand peace. Well, this is only one way then. You have to dominate, but again, it's not in the cards. So I think this is the frustration. If we want peace in a multipolar world, it can't be a peace we dictate. It's going to have to do what we haven't done in decades, that is sit down with their opponent, recognizing we both have valid, legitimate security concerns, and find out a compromise. Again, the opposite of simply peace through strength. So, no, I think this is part of the problem.
Danny, we have a new Truth Social from Trump just out, talking about how weapons are not being shuffled around. He says, President Xi at our recent meeting in Beijing, China, told me that he would not, under any circumstances, give or sell weapons to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that statement includes Chinese companies. He says, considering our relationship, I take him at his word. Besides, I'm doing him very big favors. Likewise, Putin, despite the horrible war that's going on in Ukraine, this remains as it does with President Zelensky. He told me that he would not sell weapons to Iran. Putin understands that I do not sell weapons to Ukraine, but to NATO countries. They pay full price, and how those weapons are distributed, I have no idea. Therefore, two major countries that people speak of often in terms of Iran are, in my opinion, not participating. If they did, it would be very bad for them. It's certainly not in their best interests.
Wow, that middle part there. He understands that I do not sell weapons to Ukraine. What? Am I reading that right? He understands I do not sell weapons to Ukraine, but to NATO countries. And how they're distributed, I have no idea. It's called the PURL program. We actually have an actual designated program, P-U-R-L, expressly that Trump himself brags at. What the hell is going on with this, Glenn? I mean, this is psychotic. I mean, could you view it any differently?
No, I guess it's putting weight to the fact that the money is going, it's the Europeans that's paying for it. I guess that's the main argument here. But no, wow. But this is, but of course, this is absurd. These are, you know, the U.S. hasn't pulled back from this war. These are still American war planners planning this. It's still American weapons being shipped into Ukraine. It's still American, intelligence agents across Ukraine that assist with the targeting, how to evade the Russian air defenses. They help to pick the targets. I mean, this is absurd. This is a war run by NATO and the U.S. playing the leading role. So the idea that we're not doing anything there, I mean, this has been 12 years now of a proxy war against Russia. And to argue that, surely the Russians wouldn't do the same because we're not actually doing it. It's absurd. Even Marco Rubio now said that, we're not really a mediator because we're clearly taking Ukraine's side. I mean, No, this, well, this is delusional stuff. But again, it's
Gary, can you, if you can pull it up from our archives here in June, I think it was early June, where Marco Rubio went before the Senate and said, "We picked a side." If you could just give me a thumbs up if you can find it, or a thumbs down if you can't, I'll track that. But let's continue on, Glenn. I mean, what does anyone do with that? I mean, you're in Europe. You're tied into a lot that's going on over there. Even with the lust that they have for war here, I mean, what are they going to think when they see this statement here about the mental capacity? And I'm being serious here, about the mental capacity of the guy making this statement that is allegedly the leader of the free world.
Well, I might think either it's manipulation or he's losing his mind in terms of buying into his own narratives. I mean, maybe if he believes it himself, then it would be true. But I'm not sure what they will think of him. But no, it's very hard to believe that this is actually real. But this is what Trump is saying. So yeah, what?
Well, I know. I was thinking, you may not have, you probably didn't see it, but there was running around on social media here last week. What looked like a true social by Trump, and he was blasting the Beatles, and he was talking about how they don't have any talent and they're third rate and all this kind of stuff. And the thing is, so many people believed it because he says crazy stuff like that. Turned out it wasn't true. Somebody had just made it up and sent it out there. So my first thought when I saw that one was, oh, I bet that's just a fake one. But that's on his post. That's on his site. And I'm dumbfounded by that.
Oh, again, how can you do satire when the reality is so crazy? But on him denying the involvement of Russia and China, and how these leaders, you know, they respect him so much that they wouldn't ever dare, you know, they respect him, they fear him, they would never supply any weapons or help with the intelligence. I think this is also a response to the media, because there's been both, well, politicians and journalists claiming that Russia and China are probably assisting Iran, given that their precision is improving, their intelligence is strengthening. There was some reference to, I think it was a CIA base in Saudi Arabia, which was targeted quite uniquely in a way that there was reason to doubt that Iranians would have had the intelligence. Again, it's not for me to tell if this is a correct assessment, but again, I would assume that at least on some level, I'm not sure to what extent, but that Russia and China would be assisting Iran for various reasons. First of all, again, with Russia, the U.S. for 12 years and still continues to fight a war against Russia through its Ukrainian proxy. And China, I think they very correctly see that they are a key target in the war against Iran. That is, you have people like Scott Bessent and U.S. senators sitting, sitting there giving interviews explaining how wonderful it is that because of our campaign, the blockade on Iran, that the Chinese aren't getting their energy. So, you know, they are also a target here. And essentially, this should also be a measurement of success, the extent to which we can deny oil to the Iranians. Well, the Iranians, you know, the Chinese do have TVs. They know what's being said. So both Russia and China have reasons to assist Iran. And furthermore, on the larger Eurasian map, they would also think that if the U.S. at some point would actually be successful in knocking out Iran, that would disrupt the entire format of integrating this greater Eurasian continent. That is, Russia refers to it as the Greater Eurasian Partnership. That is, the Chinese have their own names, but essentially integrating Eurasia in terms of the technologies, the industries, the transportation corridors, both by land and sea, the banks, the use of national currencies. Not a centralized format for integration, but connecting closer. And, something that would reduce the reliance on the more U.S.-centric international economic architecture. So this is their goal. So they know that if Iran is knocked out, this puts a hole in their geoeconomic project, but it also poses a huge military challenge in the future as well, because U.S. and NATO would probably use this as a way of destabilizing both the underbelly of Russia, but also China. So there's no way they can let the U.S. succeed in Iran. So again, I don't know. No one from Beijing or Moscow is telling me what they're doing, but the idea that they're not even giving intelligence, let them know where the main missiles are. I mean, when the Iranians are striking HIMARS and ATACMS, these are HIMARS and ATACMS that would otherwise be used to kill Russians, that would possibly be used in a future war against China. Why on God's green earth wouldn't they help Iran to bleed out these weapon systems?
And especially when you consider that we give billions of dollars of weapons to Taiwan, specifically to deter and defend against a potential Chinese attack there. And obviously for 4.5 years, actually a lot more than 4.5 years, against Russia through Ukraine to kill Russians on a regular basis. And now it's even getting more deeper and more problematic into Russia. We'll talk about that here in just a minute. But golly, Gary, can you bring that Truth Social back up? I want to just really make this point here very clear, so no one's confused about it, because it's just, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but this is so far out of any kind of craziness there, where I highlight that part in the middle there, Gary, about where I don't sell weapons to Ukraine. He understands that I do not sell weapons to Ukraine, but to NATO countries, and they feel full price, and how they are distributed, I have no idea. Then in light of that, how can he reconcile what his Secretary of State said in Senate testimony under oath?
We remain ready to play any role we can in that context of bringing a peace about, because we think the war in Ukraine, devastating war, has no military solution. It can only be solved through a diplomatic route, and it's been unfruitful. I would characterize it as the ongoing challenges. That said, let's be clear. We are not, to be fair and to be frank, we are not impartial mediators in that war. Okay? We don't provide weapons to Russia. We only provide weapons to Ukraine. We don't impose sanctions on Ukraine. We only impose sanctions on Russia. So we have clearly taken a side. We continue to sell weapons to Ukraine, by the way, through the Pearl Program, unimpeded by what's happened in the Middle East or anywhere else. And look, we'd love to see that come to a negotiated settlement. As of right now, the prospects don't look great.
He specifically and expressly said, we sell weapons to Ukraine through the Pearl Program. And President Trump here says, I do not sell weapons to Ukraine. I mean, that's why I say that this is just otherworldly kind of crazy talk. I mean, there's the video. It's out there. I'm not the only one who remembered him saying that just last month. And so everybody else is going to. So I don't understand. What if, okay, let's look at this from a different perspective. You're Vladimir Putin. You're Sergei Lavrov. How are you going to deal with the United States in trying to bring this war to an end?
Well, I think they've given up on diplomacy. Again, they hope that the Europeans will stop the blockade on diplomacy. Of course, if the Americans want to talk, they will talk. But their trust in the diplomatic path, I think that died after Anchorage, when, you know, the way the Russians presented, at least, is that the Americans came. They came with a proposal which implied some Russian concessions. It's unclear what those concessions were, but there was indications from Lavrov and others that they were willing to make some concessions, which were painful. From what I've heard, it entailed, not 100% on this, but what I've heard was that the Russians were willing to have a Ukraine which restores its neutrality, which was, again, the foundation of Istanbul, and in terms of the territorial conflict that has derived from it, they would be willing to accept Donbass. Well, they have to have all of Donbass, but for Kherson and Zaporizhia, they would freeze the front lines where they are. And this was, from what I heard, the American proposal. The Russians accepted it. And then the U.S. began to walk the whole thing back. And the Russians were left with the impression that the Americans didn't actually want to put an end to the war. They were merely in the process of outsourcing that war to the Europeans to make them pay for it and to make themselves frontline states, which, again, continuing the war could be seen as being in the strategic interest of the U.S. to the extent that it weakens Russia further. And especially now that the drones are being sent that allows NATO to target deep inside Russia, that it has a further ability to weaken Russia. And at the same time, the conflict between the Europeans and Russia only makes the European more dependent on the U.S. and more obedient as well. So this is the way they see it now. So, and they've been watching the diplomacy in Iran, which has been very deceptive all along. Further explanation is not required. So I think what they assume will happen now is more fraudulent diplomacy. So they will continue to seek territorial gain as a reassurance of a stable peace after this war. And
let me ask you this question here, because I'm just dropped on us, so I'm processing even as we're talking. But putting myself in the adversarial role, how I would view this, Russia and Iran in the two conflicts there, to me, this is like, because of all kinds of things that have happened already, I think it's a given that no one trusts a word that we say. No one trusts a signature on any document, period. I mean, so I don't think that there's any belief in that. And to the extent that either of those two parties were willing to enter into any kind of diplomacy was only, all right, well, if we can put some kind of quid pro quo in here or get something up front, then maybe there's still some room to go down, because if they provide something before we do something else, then maybe we can somehow get out. But when you see something like this and this direct contradiction with what the president and the secretary of state has said, and what is obvious here, to me, this would say to Russia, there's no point in talking to anything. If you're Iran, there's no point in talking to anything. We're just going to try and have to solve this militarily on the battlefield, because they can't even be sane in what they're talking about. Do you see it differently?
No, I agree with that. Well, I could add an additional thing, though. That is, they know that this is fake, and surely Trump knows that the Russians know. But they probably assume that his main intended audience would be his domestic audience, because he promised them to get out of the Ukraine war, and he has made the Ukraine war a Trump war. That is, the U.S. is still deeply involved, and it's selling weapons. As Rubio said, they're pushing sanctions as hard as they can. The goal is to break Russia, but to make the Europeans pay the heavier load. So no, again, it could be that they're simply thinking, well, this is meant for his domestic audience because he was supposed to be the peace president. That being said, I think this is also problematic for them, because we need, not just in the U.S., in Europe as well, we need a more honest discussion about what we're doing. I mean, if you're in Europe, say that NATO is participating in the strikes on Russia, it's considered Russian propaganda, and you will be smeared and censored, and you will have some profound problems. But we're not accepting our own role in this. I mean, the U.S. public should know that the U.S. is still deeply involved in a war against Russia, something Tucker Carlson had a great segment on recently. And the reason why we need to know this is because we need to know the danger we're facing, because the Russians at this point see increased, more and more escalation from NATO, more and more direct involvement by NATO. And also, we're going to see in a few months, you're going to see the Ukrainian army beginning to struggle profoundly on the battlefield. And at that point, you're going to have NATO countries becoming panicked again in terms of trying to slow down the Russian advance. And then they might do something stupid, like escalating even further. So the main challenge now in Russia, the main thing causing a lot of concern, is how do we restore a deterrent? Because we allow the NATO to go too far. I mean, NATO countries can strike deep inside Russia. You can have NATO countries speaking openly about how would we need to bring the war to Russia. Let's build thousands of ballistic missiles and drones long range so we can strike deep into Russia. We'll hand them to Ukraine, pretend as if this is our Ukrainians launching them. I mean, this is what we're doing. And, it's very dangerous. It's self-delusion. So the Russians need to restore their deterrence, which means they have to, at some point, strike back against NATO. We're going down a very dangerous path. 2026 is going to be extremely dangerous. And when you add the chaos in Iran, possible a huge economic crisis hitting later this year, there's going to be a lot of unpredictable behavior. So we should have some honest discussion about our own involvement in this war ever since 2014 against Russia, but we don't. And I think probably the Russians are a bit worried that Trump is feeding this delusional stuff to his own home audience as well.
Now, and as we showed at the top of the show here, that's not working anymore. I mean, he's starting, like you said there, if we lose Walter Cronkite, that's when we lost the Vietnam War. And if he loses Fox News, I don't think that he's going to hang on to anything else here either. And the American people, the reason why he might lose Fox News is because the American people are already way over in that direction. This kind of stuff is not going to help it out any. Let me ask you from a European perspective, though. I think that an argument could be made that many of the European leaders like Ursula von der Leyen, Kaja Kallas, especially Mark Rutte, they're just as bad as anybody. I showed the Jack Keynes and the Kellogg's in terms of saying things that are just nonsense and just self-evidently untrue, but they say them with conviction all the time. Is there a possibility of a similar dynamic happening in Europe to where people are going to finally say, you guys are so far detached from reality, we're not buying it anymore? Or are they just going to keep taking what they're spoon-fed?
Well, the U.S. doesn't monopolize on having the dishonest warmongers, so we have plenty of them in Europe as well. And, well, their credibility is also collapsing. But you see a general trend, though, that is people have less and less trust in the politicians. If you look at the larger powers in Europe, from Britain, France, Germany, their leaders are just at historical lows. Well, the British try to change the leadership now, but it's not going to work. It's essentially the same people. And people don't trust less and less the media as well. You can only say that your opponents are losing so many times before people begin to figure out that something's wrong. One day the media is saying that, we're in Iran, bombing Iran because we want to help to liberate the oppressed people there. Next day, we're going to destroy that entire civilization, making nuclear not so very covert threats. People are, I think, seeing through this. But in this vacuum, though, of political illegitimacy, what it's leaving behind is you do see new political forces emerging. You see in Britain, you see France, you see Germany. Germany especially, where AfD is rising, and you have the leader of AfD. She made the point that if they take power, the first thing she would do is go to Moscow and, try to improve relations again, reset relations with Russia, that this has been a mistake. She said she would drop by Kiev and demand to get all their money back as well.
See that one.
Some people are starting to oppose this because the problem is a lot of this goes strictly against one's own national interests. And I would put the same to the United States. That is, a lot of what it's doing now, I think, is a failure to adjust to new realities. I mean, after the Cold War, the U.S. saw the main security interest being in pursuing a hegemonic peace, just being everywhere at every time, and being so dominant that no one could challenge it. This was the source of security. But the problem with this, already recognized in the 90s, was over time the U.S. would exhaust its resources and all the rising powers, which do not want to live under our global hegemon, would then begin to collectively balance the U.S. Well, this is what you see. The U.S. is almost $40 trillion in debt. You see large powers, as diverse as Russia, China, Iran, Brazil, all of them finding common cause in pursuing a post-hegemonic system, not anti-American, but anti-hegemonic, and it's an important difference. So you would think now for the U.S., it would be in America's interest to take a step back, that is, away from trying to be everywhere at the same time, begin to prioritize, as the national security strategy of December last year suggested, and allow the Eurasian powers to begin to balance each other instead of collectively balance the U.S. I mean, this was at the heart of America's offshore balancer strategy, and I think this is where they need to go. But the U.S. isn't doing it, and then they're ignoring their own interest. And I think in Europe, they're doing the same. This idea that, if we only try to defeat the Russians, then America will stay in Europe. The Ukrainians will be our, perpetual front line against Russia. All of this is going against their own national interests. I also make the point, sorry to drag on, but in Germany, if you want to have economic development, you need to have a good economic relationship with Russia. If you want to have security, as Bismarck once said, the secret to security is a good peace deal with the Russians, because those are the two large European land powers. So again, if you're German, you want economic development, you want security, you have to take into consideration the Russians. but they don't. They essentially say anything that's good for Russia is pro-Putin, and you can't do that. So they are essentially structurally setting themselves up for ignoring their own national interest. And you can only do this for so long until an opposition comes along. And if you see in the German news, they're quite worried now because you're going to have elections in Berlin, I think, and the AfD will likely make a historic victory. At least that's what the polls say. So
we'll see where that's going to go. There. What seems to be mitigating against that, though, is that all these people who have, I just mentioned some of him a minute ago, have literally made their careers on saying, no, we're going to defeat Russia politically, economically, whatever means. Eventually, we just got to wear them down with these, whatever, 100 rounds of sanctions, wherever they're ended up heading in. But one of the things that seems to be giving them some a little bit of additional energy right now is this claim that they're actually starting to work. And now here we see, I think the third Wildberries thing was hit in St. Petersburg last night. And every time they hit these things, there's this massive black smoke that goes up or whatever. And it gives the impression and encouragement, I think, to those in the West. See, this is hurting Russia economically. Forget about the sanctions. This is actually causing some real economic damage to their country. And all we got to do is just keep going. And then Putin's going to finally realize he's going to have to make peace. How do you see that dynamic? And what do people actually believe in Europe?
Well, I think it's the same flaw as they're doing with the Iranians, that is seeing, look how much stuff we're blowing up in Iran. We're winning. But again, it's a very poor measurement of success because you can blow up whatever you want. But if your opponent is fighting a war which they consider to be an existential threat, they will absorb this pain. And we're seeing that the economic targeting or the targeting of economic assets of Russia is not affecting the front lines. If anything, the Russians are doing very well at the moment. And you even hear from the Ukrainian military that things look very poorly on the front lines. But again, we're not here for helping Ukraine. That is NATO. The goal is to use Ukraine to inflict some economic pain on Russia. And I think this is causing economic pain. I mean, Wildberries, it's their largest e-commerce. If you want to cause havoc and destruction in Russia, this is the kind of things you would want to do. But again, the problem is the same with Iran. Russia considers this to be an existential threat. Russia can only accept this kind of NATO-backed attacks on Russia to the extent it's sustainable and they can absorb the costs. If the more successful we are, the more we should be worried, because if this is something that could essentially start to break Russia, then we should be very worried, because Russia isn't going to essentially say, well, look at all the economic pain NATO brought to us. I guess we'll capitulate. We'll accept that the Ukraine will join NATO. We'll have all of America's missiles and drones filled up in Ukraine along our borders. Why not open all those CIA bases again? It's not going to happen. So all one is doing, if capitulation is not an option for Russia, what exactly do we think a victory will look like? Because they will escalate. And I think we're heading towards a direct war between NATO and Russia, which could very quickly escalate into a nuclear exchange. So, I mean, imagine if the shoe was on the other foot. Imagine if it was the Russians who had toppled the government in Mexico. They were then now pumping in missiles and drones to strike deep inside, Washington, D.C., New York. And they were essentially measuring success by how much destruction they could bring to the U.S. because they know the U.S. will be a bit cautious to retaliate against Russia due to fear of unleashing nuclear war. Yeah, that's fine and well, but how far can you push the Americans before they reach the conclusion, okay, we can't absorb this pain anymore. We're not going to capitulate and live with a forever, Russian troops and missiles in Mexico. At some point, the Americans would escalate, and you don't want that. And I think that's the same logic the Russians are having. That is, this can only go so far. And there are now very loud voices in Moscow arguing that this red line has already been crossed, and it's time to do something.
And what do you make of the tactics that Ukraine is using? Because it appears that they have moved on to different, more civilian targets, more economic targets, because presumably Russia is this massive land country spread out over 12 time zones and all that. You can't literally defend every inch of the country anywhere. So you have to prioritize the things that are really important, military and industrial, et cetera, that can keep the war effort going. And that means that some places like these Wildberry places are going to not be defended, because it looks like I know this is new video evidence. I haven't even seen this. Thanks, Gary. Because you see, these are just drones coming in and nothing's going up to try and take them down. And it's causing just substantial damage. How do you see this change of tactics by the Ukraine side?
Well, it's helping to hit economic targets. But again, to what extent is going to help them win the war? I doubt it's going to have the desired effect. But again, the main security threat for the Russians is not just economic; it's also the lack of deterrence. Which again, the NATO countries listen to European leaders and journalists. They don't even take the Russian nuclear deterrent serious anymore. They would never dare to do anything. They don't dare to confront NATO. I mean, this is what the Russians now see. This has to be the main objective, to strike some fear into the hearts of people across the NATO countries, that is, to restore its deterrence. But what you said about the drones, I think is a very excellent point. That is, the strategic depth of Russia, that is its massive territory, has always been a key asset. It's how it defeated Napoleon, that they could absorb these troops and cut off their supply.
Great point.
They did the same with Hitler, and even with during the Cold War with the U.S., they would have the strategic depth would also enhance their the likely effectiveness of their second strike capability. So it's always been important, but of course it also is a vulnerability to the extent they're not able to defend everything. And so it is a big problem. So I think the way the Russians will respond is, yes, they will improve their air defenses, which they're working on. But also it's about retaliating. And again, I've seen the same media reports, you know, how we're celebrating across NATO countries, how the Ukrainians are now striking these Russian vessels. But then, of course, we never think what's going to happen the next day. How the Russians going to react? Are they going to capitulate? No. They're now attacking all the Ukrainian ships, not just the Ukrainians, but any ship heading towards the ports of Odessa or Nikolaev. Yeah. They're destroying the ports facilities. They're essentially de facto making Ukraine a landlocked country. It's quite dramatic. And also, they used to be quite cautious about hitting Kyiv earlier, even though they had good intelligence where the weapons manufacturers were. You didn't really see them being touched to such a great extent. Now, it's open market. They're hitting Kyiv in quite a brutal way. You see them getting closer now to Sumy, lesser so, but still also moving towards Kharkov. Russia can retaliate in other ways. I think this is why escalate when you know that the opponent can do something much worse in kind? I think that's what you're going to see now. And just add one thing, NATO should ask itself the same question. Because we keep thinking we're untouchable, we can do whatever we want to Russia. But these little tweets by Trump that, we're not selling them weapons. I mean, it's not going to work with the Russians. So at some point, the retaliation will come.
Well, and that's what we're just waiting for that other shoe to drop. And we seem just hell-bent on keeping giving Russia every reason to drop that other shoe. We'll have to see how that's going to work out, but it's almost certainly not going to be good for our side. But as always, we appreciate you coming on today, Glenn, and giving us this clarity here, and remind people the Glenn Deason excellent podcast and YouTube show where he has great guests and great topics all the time. I love to watch that myself. Thank you very much for coming on. Always appreciated.
It's great to see you again, Danny. Thanks.
And we will appreciate you guys, too. And we'll see you back at 1 o'clock today with the ever amazing Ambassador Chas Freeman, who is going to look at things from the diplomatic vantage point when he comes back today. And I can't wait to hear what he's going to say on this crazy Truth Social post by President Trump. Probably not going to be moving us in a good diplomatic direction. But we'll have to see what the ambassador has to say at 1 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you then. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.